the book of Deuteronomy, in which Moses reiterates the law to the children of Israel. They had been in the wilderness for 40 years. They had kind of wandered around from place to place. When the pillar of smoke or fire went up from the tabernacle, they would disassemble everything and move to where the pillar went. When it stopped, they would reset up camp. They would set back up the tabernacle, and the presence of God would be there with them. It was that way for 40 years. Every morning when they woke up, they had manna on the ground. Every evening when they went out of their tents, they had quail on the ground to have dinner. They were taken care of every day of their life for 40 years. Their clothes didn't wear out. Their shoes didn't wear out. Children grew into manhood and womanhood. Families were started. Kids, babies born. All of these things took place for 40 years. And as they were sitting on the eastern side of the Jordan River in what we now call Lebanon, pretty much near the Golan Heights in Israel, there they sat waiting to cross the Jordan River. Moses reiterates the law and God's wishes to the people. We talked about specifically chapters 4 and chapters 11, where God really just almost begged them to follow His commandments. And if they did, they would have life and good. If they didn't, they would have death and evil. And you go on and on and you see all the great things that God had done for them, what He wanted for His people. And here they stood at this place waiting to cross. Clear over in the end of the book, just before we get to the book of Joshua, starting in about Deuteronomy 30, we'll see the end of Moses' life. Moses, by this time, was 120 years old. Deuteronomy 30, verse 1, it says, "It shall come to pass when these things..." This talks about the blessing of returning to God, because the people had sort of couldn't make up their mind whether to follow God or not. There had already been some problems. There had been some people killed. Thousands of them, really. So God's telling Moses, He says, "It shall come to pass when all these things come upon you, the blessing and the curse which I have set before you, that you shall call them to mind among the nations where the Lord drives you." And He's talking about after they've been there and after they've gone away from God, that if they come back, they're going to get reinvigorated. Notice it says that He's going to drive them away if they follow the command, you and your children with all your heart. In verse 3, that the Lord your God will bring you back from captivity. See, here we're talking about prophecies that were yet to come, uprooted and so forth. Verse 11, "This command which I command you today is not mysterious. It's been explained over and over again." And if we've been in the church anything over about 5 years and gone to a feast or two or three or whatever, we've had the law read to us. We've been through Passover. We've been through Pentecost. We've been through the feast. We've had the law read to us as well. It's not mysterious, is it? There's only 10 commandments. It's a very simple thing to follow this life. And God is telling this, and Moses is reiterating, it's not mysterious so that it's so far off. It's not in heaven that you should say we have to ascend to heaven, like they tried to do at the Tower of Babel. He says, "Would we ascend to heaven and bring it back to us? Nor is it beyond the sea that we should say we can't go beyond the sea and bring it to us. But the word is very near to you, in your mouth and in your mind." If we let God put it in our minds, and we don't have to look at some tablet on the wall or have a tassel on our belt loop or whatever and carry this thing around with us to remind us all the time, it's supposed to be here. That's what God was trying to tell the people of the day. Put it here and obey me, and I will take care of your every need. Verse 15, he says, "See, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil." It's really two things here. There's not this vast void in the middle of gray area which man has set up. It's very simple according to God. You follow me, I take care of you. You don't, you know the circumstances that you're going to go into. They had already been told all of these things, the blessings and cursings. He says, in that I command you today, verse 16, to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, and to keep his commandments, his statutes, and his judgments, that you may live and multiply. Now notice he didn't say that their life was going to be perfect and then they would never have a trial. It said, I will take care of you and bless you if you follow me. Same is really true for us today. And he said that he would bless them in the land in which they went to possess. Verse 17, but if your heart turns away so that you do not hear and are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I announce to you today that you shall surely perish. It's interesting that he says this because if you go back to Numbers 25, that's exactly what happened. When they were supposed to conquer the Moabites before they went into the Holy Land, they decided that the women looked so pretty that they would let them come into them. They married them, they served their gods, and many of them were destroyed because of it. And God sort of brings this up and says, look, you have in your recent history something that took place, and you see what I did to you. Please follow me, and I will make the way for you. Chapter 31, Moses then announces, I'm 120 years old. I can no longer go out or come in. The Lord has said to me, you shall not cross over the Jordan. The Lord himself, notice, the Lord your God himself crosses over before you. He will destroy these nations from before you, and you shall dispossess them. Joshua crosses before you, just as the Lord has said. In other words, now Joshua is taking over from Moses. Joshua, at this point, is now 80 years old. He has been Moses' assistant, basically, for 40 years. He's had a chance to watch God work in Moses' life. He's had a chance to see what God did for them when they obeyed and what happened when they didn't. He is well complete and ready to take over the reins. But he also needs help in this. Down in verse 9, Moses wrote this law, delivered it to the priest, the son of Levi, who bore the ark of the Lord, to all the commandments. They're supposed to read it every 7 years. Why? To remind them of the law, to keep them up on the law so that they obey it. And this happened during the fall festivals. Verse 14, there is a prediction of Israel's rebellion. Behold, the days approach when you must die, he says to Moses, call Joshua and present yourselves in the tabernacle of meeting that I may inaugurate him. So Moses and Joshua go up to the tabernacle. The Lord appeared in the tabernacle in the pillar of cloud, and the pillar of cloud stood above the door of the tabernacle. God's presence was there with them. The Lord said to Moses, behold, you will rest with your fathers, and this people will rise and play the harlot with the gods of the foreigners of the land where they go to be among them, and they will forsake me and break my covenant. Again, another prediction. You sort of wonder, you know, I wonder myself reading this how, and I guess it's, knowing what I know, and I suppose having a measure of the Holy Spirit, I wonder how the people could see all of the things that took place in their lifetime had they thought, you know, that their sandals never wore out, and the shoes never, the clothes never wore off, the tents that they used never wore out and had to be replaced. All the things that they had in their life, all the safety, all the water when they needed it, food day and night. How could you not know there's a presence of God, especially when it's in the tabernacle, a meeting in a cloud and a pillar? How could you not turn your heart to God? Because that's all he ever asked, that they would turn from their stiff neck way and follow him. I just have trouble figuring out why they would listen to these words and then just go about their life as if it didn't matter. Continuing, he says, then my anger shall be aroused against them in that day, and I will forsake them, and I'll hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured, and many evils and troubles will befall them, so that they will say in that day, have these evils not come upon us because our God is not among us? See, why would it take such a catastrophe for then you could turn around and go, oh, wait a minute. Why? Because that's kind of what it appears. They'll go off down a path so far that they get lost, and then they turn around and wonder, how come I'm lost? God has already told him what would happen, that he would hide his face. So We have that backdrop then, so that when they begin to go into the land, when we go over to Joshua, we see some interesting things. In chapter 1, starting in verse 10, Joshua commands the officers of the people, pass through the camp, command, prepare your provisions, for within 3 days we're going to cross the Jordan. And he sets this whole scenario up. The Reubenites, the Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh are going to be the leaders of the army. They're going to be right behind the ark. Ark takes off first. As the priests go out and stand in the water in Jordan, and in springtime, the Jordan is very, very wide. It overflows its boundaries because there's a lot of rain. They were going to step in the water, and the water was going to back up. Armies are going to go through on dry land, just like the Israelites did in Moses' day when they crossed the Red Sea. See, history is repeating itself. Joshua's going to get to see firsthand how God sets him up to be the leader, and now as he follows God, things go well. And the children, this second generation of children who are now going to have to be circumcised, are going to see with their own eyes how God takes care of them if they follow God. It's all repeated, as it's repeated in our lives in a lot of times. So the Reubenites, the Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh settle on the eastern side of the Jordan River. That's where they're going to stay. They're already at peace. Their families are already there. Therefore, the armies are going to go out and fight and help the brothers. They send spies into the land, into Jericho. Rahab hides them, gives them safety so that they leave after they've spied out the land. She tells the spies that the people's hearts have melted. And when you start looking what that word means, their courage is just evaporated. They're scared to death. They're quaking in their boots because they know what's coming by reputation of that pillar and that cloud that has been leading these people for 40 years. They've also heard about the victories that have taken place in the desert. So that they are scared. They heard about what happened in the Red Sea 40 years before. They know the history of this people. And then over in chapter 5, something really, really strange happens. Tabernacle has been packed away. It's all wrapped up and put on the ox carts. The Ark of the Covenant is crossing over the Jordan River, and they're marching towards Jericho, mind you. And in chapter 5, verse 13, it came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, a man with a capital M on it stood opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. Joshua walked up to him. If you're going towards a city and you see somebody there, you immediately think adversary. That's where your mind goes. Here's somebody who has come out of this city to oppose. Joshua went up to him and said, "Are you for us or for our adversaries? Are you for us or against us? Who do you represent?" So he said, capital H-E, "No, but as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come." Stop and think for just a second. That pillar of cloud in whose presence the Lord Jesus Christ dwelt was now standing before Joshua, just like the presence was in the burning bush at the mountain. Think about that for just a minute. Joshua has walked out and come face to face with the commander of the army of God. I mean, you can't get your mind around that, can you? Here is somebody in a man's skin, visage, with his sword drawn. You can imagine how heavy that may have been, because this man could have been very powerful, standing there addressing Joshua as the commander of the army of God. "Take off your sandal off your foot, for the place you stand is holy." History repeats itself again. God, who had been in the pillar since they left Egypt, was now standing in front of the army. Harkens back to what was said, that God would fight the battles. God would fight the battles. Now the setup here for Jericho was pretty interesting. City with high walls around it, fortified, gates closed, army at the ready. And here comes this ragtag band with this funny looking apparatus out in front of it, about 3/4 of a mile away. Here's the armies. And they march around the city once every day for 6 days. Then they go back to their camp. 7th day, they come out. And they marched not once, not twice, but 7 times around that city Remember, Rahab had already said the people were quaking in their boots. You can imagine what this spectacle must have been like. Maybe on the first and second day, people started laughing. Oh, they're not going to do anything. Third and fourth day, what the world are they doing? And on the seventh day, when this army goes around this city seven times, how laborious that must have been. And now these people are watching all this. The instructions were, after the seventh time, blow your trumpet and shout, and the walls will fall down. Now think about that. Here's a company of soldiers, second generation, who hadn't seen all the things that took place in their parents' day, marching into war, not knowing what's going on. We march into life every day at pretty much the same pace, don't we? And the walls fell down. The walls fell down. What'd they do? Was there a cannon fired? The armies rushed the place and knocked them down. They caught up on ladders? No. They just shouted and the walls fell over. Rubble. And because they had surrounded the city and there's all this mayhem going on, all the soldiers rush in from every side and kill man, woman, and child, save Rahab and her family, just as they had been promised. So you can imagine the exultation that must have been when all is said and done. They're victorious. They go back to their camps, chest out. Look what we did. There had to be some of that. There had to be. There was also some other things that had took place. If you jump over to chapter 7, you read where Achan had not obeyed what they were told, and he had secretly taken some articles of silver and gold and other things and hid them in his tent. He had sinned and therefore brought shame on the whole nation of Israel. So much so that in the beginning of chapter 7, when they approached Ai, however you pronounce it, the spies went out, looked over the city, very small little city compared to Jericho, and they came back and told Joshua, we only need about 3,000 guys. We can take this. No sweat. And when you read the words, you almost think that's about how they said it. In that way, no big deal. This is easy. So a small army goes up to the city. The people of the city come out and defeated them and killed 36 people, by the way. And they had to turn tail and run. So Joshua, he's on his knees and he's crying and forlorn. Why, God, have you allowed us to do this? Why couldn't you leave us in Egypt? In chapter 7, verse 10, notice what he says. The Lord said to Joshua, get up. Why are you laying down on the job? You can imagine what this must have sounded like to Joshua. Get up. Israel has sinned. Joshua didn't know what had taken place. He's thinking everything's cool. He's thinking that his might is going to win this battle. They're just going to be victorious. Nothing's going to happen. He's so quickly forgotten the words that he was told, that the commander will fight the battles, that if they obey God, they would be protected and be blessed. That's all been forgotten somehow. And now he's mourning the loss of his soldiers and wondering, how in the world could God have let them down? Kind of sounds like us sometimes, doesn't it? When we have a trial, woo, and we so easily get into the dumps. God has to explain here. Israel has sinned, transgressed the covenant which I commanded them. They've even taken some of the accursed things. They've stolen and deceived, and they have put it amongst their own stuff. Joshua then had to go through every tribe, every clan, every family, down to every tent, till he found the tent and the family where the stuff was hidden. And then that family was destroyed because they sinned. He owned up to it. But that family lost their life, that whole family, not just the soldier, but every member of the family, parents, grandparents, nephews, nieces, all of them lost their family because of sin. Very hard lesson. Let's go back to chapter 1 and notice something here. in God's dealing with Joshua. And had he listened, had he kept this in the forefront of his mind, it probably wouldn't have happened. Joshua 1:1. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spoke to Joshua the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, and said, Moses, my servant, is dead. Therefore arise, go over this Jordan, you and all the people, to the land which I am giving you, the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given you. Notice, I have given you. It's a done thing. When I read that, I think about Romans 8. We are children of God if the Spirit is here. It's a done deal. That's how emphatic God is here. It's done. It's not maybe. It's not if. It's done in His mind. He is not going to fail. We do. They did. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread, I have given you, as I said to Moses, from the wilderness and this Lebanon, as far as the great river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, and to the great sea, the Mediterranean. So you can imagine, from somewhere up around Baghdad, Iran, all the way over, all the way down, is a very big land when you go clear down almost to Egypt. It's not this little sliver that they have now that it resembles Rhode Island. This is a very large national area. And if you read the rest of Joshua and you see their journeys and you see where the battles took place, you can find them on a map. It's a very large area that Israel settled in. But here's what I want to get to. All of this toward the going down of the sun shall be your territory. Verse 5, no man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so will I be with you. Notice the promise. What promise were we given when we were dunked into death? When hands were laid upon us, we got this same promise. Wherever you go, whatever you do, if you're obeying me, I'm with you. Notice what else he says here. I will be with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you. Those words were said to the disciples, and by extension, us. These words are written to believers. I will not leave you nor forsake you. Be strong and of good courage. Does it say, go to school 4 years and learn military strategies? Does it say go learn, you know, Tai Chi and Taekwondo and Tai Tai, whatever else? No. It says be strong and of good courage. Don't let your heart falter like they did in Jericho. Like it did standing before the wall of that little bitty city you thought you could take with 3,000 people. With your might. Be strong and of good courage, for to this people you shall divide as inheritance the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Verse 7, the second time. Only be strong and very courageous, that you may notice, observe to do according to the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Notice what he didn't say? He didn't say anything about military might. He didn't say anything about lifting weights, running 3 miles a day. You know what I mean? It's not what we're made of here. It's what we're made of here. If our minds are receptive to the words, if our minds are obedient to the words, then our hands follow. God is telling Joshua that he wanted a follower of him, not a mighty man of valor, not a weightlifter, not a long-distance runner. He wants somebody who will follow him. Have faith. Faith begets belief, begets obedience, begets righteousness. That's what God wanted. That's what God's wanted since day one. And if you read the whole book, it's the same thing. Only be strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand, nor to the left, that you may prosper wherever you go. It's interesting that where I work, this really comes back to hit me from time to time. especially when I see what goes on in the center. You know, they have Torah studies. They're very diligent about learning about the Torah. They learn Hebrew in the Jewish Community Center of Dallas, Texas. But there's also this other side of them who are very secular, who are very money-minded, who are very power-minded, who are very arrogant about their heritage. And they end up following their own tradition rather than what they teach, the Torah. And it's true of almost all peoples on the earth today. Or no matter what day they go to church. And it happens, and there's some cases even in God's church. Sabbath keepers have a mentality of tradition over belief and obedience. We've been around long enough, we've seen some of it. It's not hard to pick out. So, I mean, we can't stand up and, you know, be proud of this, that, or the other thing unless we are proud of our belief, proud of our obedience in that God allows us and shows us the way. Continuing, it says, "This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate in it day and night." Notice what book we're supposed to meditate on, be trained in, learn from, and be obedient to. No book but this. And here we have colleges all over the world. We have this philosophy and that philosophy and this belief and that belief. And we have opinion after opinion after opinion on everything but God. And we're just as bad about following as everybody else. So were the Israelites. Be honest. "You shall meditate in it day and night that you may observe to do according to what is written in it. For then you will be able to make your way prosperous and have good success." Verse 9. "Have I not commanded you already twice? Be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid." There are a lot of people afraid today. They start looking at the ticker tape on CNBC or whatever station they're looking at, and they see the fluctuations in the market. Especially if you walk into the little cafe where I work, there's a lot of people sit there and they watch that thing all day. What's my money doing today? They're very worried about the markets. They're worried about things going on. And you start looking around, we see our freedoms being eroded, you see the oil in the Gulf and all the things that are coming with that. You start looking at Europe and the Euro and a hundred other things, and you can be afraid. But this says, "Do not be afraid. Be strong and of good courage. Don't be dismayed, for God is with you wherever you go." If Joshua had listened to that and obeyed that and paid attention to that every day, there wouldn't have been that defeat in that little bitty town that they thought they could capture with only 3,000 people. When Joshua came to his senses and took care of the sin that was within the camp, they then went back to that city and destroyed it. They did just what they did before. They sent a small force up to the gate, and out come the men. But the men in the city didn't know that there was an ambush waiting behind, that when the people went out, soldiers went in, burned the city. The bad guys turned around and looked at what was going on and were surrounded on all sides and killed. God fought their battle. Their idea was just to march up, knock on the door, and go, "Hey." Now, that was, you know, what they figured was going to happen, that their hearts would melt and they would quiver and shake, and that would be that. Small little bitty town. They didn't understand that God expected them to obey His word and not take from the accursed things. What then is the lesson for us? Are we arrogant enough in our own whatever that we think we don't need God? All the things that Helen and I have seen in the last 6 or 8 weeks makes me really, really understand it's not by my might or my power, but God's grace that I'm able to thank everyone on that camera in this room or wherever you may be for all the blessings that we've received. I didn't do it. Didn't start the fire either, but you know what I'm saying. I didn't cause this. I didn't manufacture this. I didn't by my own strength and
whatever, come up with the blessings that I have.
I just get up every day and go to work. I try to do the best I can. When I come home, I take care of my family. And maybe I spend a little time here thinking, okay, what can I do to be better? And that's all God ever asked His people. All God wants us to do is have a willing mind to be obedient. The rest takes care of itself. If we become stiff-necked and think we've got it covered on our own, it's when we falter. We can't falter, brethren. We can't. We can't depend on our might. We can't depend on our education. We can't depend on wealth or anything else material in this life. It's nice to enjoy what we have. It's nice to use what we have. But the days are coming when all that may well be taken away from us. If we try to hide, we're going to be found. If we try to stick it out, we're going to be uncovered. Every one of us will stand before somebody sometime and answer for our faith and our belief. Be strong and of good courage.